Okay, good morning.
It is a good morning.
Yes, it is. And we can see that it's a good morning because of the wispy style of the clouds, which we'll get to. Now, this morning is sponsored by John and Marion Kramer in memory of John's mother, whose name, remind me, John?
Rivka Bat Chaim
Altam. And the Shema Haven Aliyah, a learning is in her memory. May memory continue to be a blessing. Our plan for today, so we know the outline, you have two pages, I hope. One is Chet, front and back, and the other is Tet, front and back. We're going to start with Chet Amud Bet, about 20 lines up, where it starts in the green Amr of Yitzchak. That's where we'll begin, that's where we're up to. And my ambition for today, though it may be over-ambitious, is to get to the end of Tet Amud Bet at the very bottom, which will finish. There's an extra word onto Daf Yud, but I figured I'll just read it at the bottom of Tet Amud Bet, and I won't give you three pages. That's my hope, though I say that knowing that may be a false hope. But that is our plan. So far, let's summarize where we're up to, and I want to welcome all those Daf Yomi doers who happen to coincide this morning with Daf Tet is Daf Yomi. So I want to thank you for joining us and express our deep regret that you're going to take over us by tomorrow morning, and that we'll see you again in about 7.5 years. But you should enjoy the week.
49.
That's true, it does depend. But I think next year you'll be in the middle of Yavamos or something, so I wish you luck on that one. I actually do know of another shul that does a Daf HaShavua program, and they did Tanit, they did Brachot, and then they did Yavamot, and then they had to stop and do something else to start again because it decimated everybody. So good luck with that, Daf Yomi. Now, what we up to? So far, we are still in the middle of dealing with the second mission of the whole Masechet. Very straightforwardly, we've summarized at the beginning of each time. The first mission said, when do we start Mashiv HaRuach, which we addressed with some meditations on providence and prayer along the way. We have the second mission that says, when do we stop saying V'tein Tol Matar? And I've repeatedly said we're going to answer that eventually. And it turns out that if you look ahead, and if I look ahead, that's actually not the case. By the time we get to the next Mishnah, we won't have even answered that question. Because it turns out we don't follow the view of this Mishnah, halachically speaking, but Chazal don't write it off. They see there's still providential ponderings to be had on the basis of the dispute. And we'll get to resolve the question of when do we stop V'tein Tol Matar later in the Masechet. But we're now in the middle of the fourth daf, the fourth page since we started that Mishnah. We've had 9 conversations with Nachman of Yitzchak back and forth about the power of words, the power of prayer. We've dealt with the etymology of Yoreh, Malkosh of Revi'ah, where these agricultural, meteorological terms come from, what they imply. And we've turned our attention to how great rain is. So far we've had 4 comparisons. Gadol Yom HaGshamim, so great is the day of rain. It's like creation, it's like revelation, it's like our final redemption, it's like the revival of the dead. And we're actually going to have another 3 or 4 comparisons today with how great rain is. So when you see it raining, one should think of, oh, this isn't irritating, this is fabulous. Having said that, the first thing we're going to see today is that actually rain can be irritating. And there's a sage that says, if I could be done with rain, if I could eliminate rain, I would. And actually that's going to be the theme of today. Everything we've said so far about the power of words, the power of prayer, the attention in providence, we're going to complicate today by saying, actually, this whole field of theology is way too complicated. There are so many different views. We can imagine that God cares about our every second, our every movement, our every moment, but also recognize that in every moment, it might not be God trying to do this to me. It might, you know, don't have hubris. And actually, we're going to have many different views. When can we test God? Have we established that we can or cannot test God so far in Masechet? Has that come up?
Yes, that come up. We can, but we shouldn't.
We can, but we shouldn't. We had 3 examples of biblical figures who tested God. We had Eliezer who tested God, we had Yiftach who tested God, and we had Shaul who tested God by saying, whoever beats Goliath can marry my sister. And we said, you can do that, but God may not respond very favorably as he did with Yiftach. So we're going to suggest today that maybe we can test God in one particular field, which actually manifests in our daily practice, or at least weekly practice. When we say Mishaberach after laning, we basically say, God bless us because what? Say, Mishaberach Adonai Rabbi Yoel, give this person blessing, Bishvil Hanoten Tzedakah, because they give Tzedakah. And it always makes, it often makes me uncomfortable It almost seems like bribery. We say, God, give them a blessing, and as long as they give tzedakah. And it certainly feels like bribery if it's like money coming to the shul, and we're like standing there saying, you know, God will bless you if you give us money. It sounds almost like an indulgence in the Catholic Church. And that's why, actually, I interpolate in the Misha Berach. I say, Bishvel shenachnu notim tzedakah umit palalim b'avaram. And we pray for them, meaning, you know, we're praying that hopefully should be a merit too. But actually, Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that it was uniquely tzedakah that we can use to test God, as what will come today. So let us begin. Davchet Amud Bet. At the bottom we begin. 20 lines of Amr B'Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Afilu Shanim Kishnei Eliyahu. Even if there were years, like the years of Eliyahu, which were varied, but particularly there were years when there was great famine. There was drought, there was no rain. Even in years like that, when there's been no rain, v'yarduk shamim barve shabbatot, and then it rains, but it's Friday, einan ela simen klala. That is a terrible thing. So, meaning we've now got a mixed blessing. We need the rain, but it's raining on Friday. We're like, you know, Hashem, come do us a favor. We've got to get to shul, we've got to get to the market, I've got to get home, I'm trying to get to work, and you're making the roads messy. It's very difficult. And what we're already establishing in just that sentence is, providence is complicated. Because this is objectively a good thing. We need rain. Subjectively, this is discomforting and uncomfortable. God is finding a way to give us what we need in a way that displays displeasure. So how can we relate to that? Hainu da'amar Rabbi Bshila, and this is exactly what Rabbi Bshila said. Kasha yom demitrika yom dedina. How terrible is the day of rain like the day of judgment? So far, rain, when we look out the window, we've been told to think about redemption, revelation, revival of the dead, and now we're being told to think about the final judgment. How am I meant to understand rain? And the answer is, it's complicated. It depends on context. Amra Mema, Amema said, Ilo tzarich lebriata, if creation didn't need it, Bainu Rahmanum Rav Itlane, I would request of God that we get rid of rain. We don't need it. And the truth is, in modern life, we've got to a point where essentially we don't need rain. Desalination in Israel, that they're now trying to implement on the West Coast, gets to a point where rain actually is just a nuisance, and we don't particularly need it. I'm not saying you should end it. I'm just saying, actually, I think I spoke about this in the drash in my first year on Sukkot, when we say Tfilat Geshem, which is so dissonant to our lives. None of us, I think, look outside and think, I need rain. You know, I might think I need my sprinkler guy to come and deal with the sprinkler, but I don't think, like, I need rain right now. And he's suggesting that maybe there's a view to what that is. Amr Rabbi Yitzchak said, Shemesh b'Shabbat staka le'niyim, but if it's sunny on Shabbos, that is charity or justice to the poor, because they get to go outside and enjoy it, and people who don't have homes get to enjoy Shabbos if there's no rain. So again, the theme is rain can be disruptive. Shne'emar v'zarach alachem yirei shmi shemesh staka marpeh. As it says in Malachi, the sun will rise for you who fear my name and bring healing. Rav Yitzchak says, okay, now we've established that rain can be complicated, let's go back to how great it is. Rav Yitzchak said, Gadol Yom, Shemesh Afilu Purjish B'Kish Merechet, but rain is amazing, because not only when rain falls, the seeds sprout, but it actually stimulates the entire economy, because once you've got the growth in the fields, you then have supply chains set up, you've got the markets begin to move, people start to bake, people sell, and actually it makes my investments go up. So that's how great rain is. It diffuses prosperity across the economy. Shne'emar, as it says, latet matarzecha be'ito, as it says, I'll give rain in your time, levarechet kol ma'asei yadecha, and all of your money will be improved. So now we're meant to think when it rains, it's asking us to think about long term when it rains, not just, oh, this is great as revelation, but that rain coming right now is making my investments greater, because it's going to stimulate the economy, which invites us to think broadly about how things happen and the interconnections. Rav Rabbi Yitzchak. Yitzchak now has a comment that's going to make us think about providence again. Having established that rain reminds us of the revival of the dead, we're now being told to think about how providence might interweave in our lives and not have overconfidence. Rav Rabbi Yitzchak. Ein bracha metsuya ela b'davar samum min ha'ayin. Bracha only comes to something which is hidden from the eye. If you've ever asked somebody how many grandkids they have, and they go, or they don't tell you. It's rooted in this kind of, I don't want to say superstition, but this hesitancy that if I give you a number, I'm inviting catastrophe. Because bracha only happens to things which are samuim and ayib, that are hidden from the eye. Shne'emar, as it says, Yitzav Hashem Ito, it's a bracha, God will command for you blessing, ba'asamecha. What does asamecha mean, anybody know? Storehouses or barns, but asamecha reflects the Aramaic samui, meaning hidden. So God only sends you bracha if it's hidden. So this is like getting your bank statement, seeing the number, and then davening Hashem, please make my bank statement change. So you've looked at the number now. God is going to have to do so many things to alter that fact. That prayer is wasted. And don't expect, and don't read the lack of a response as God's not interested. You're playing with fire if you're trying God to change the cosmos in such ways. Tanu Rabbi Yishmael B'Shemuel says in Bracha B'Shelo B'Davar She'en Ha'ein Shalotei Bo, slight variation, where Bracha only comes on something that the eyes, not, it's hidden from the eyes, but the eyes cannot see, which is a far more narrow vision of providence. It suggests that God isn't going to, you know, you're driving along, he's not going to make things jump out the way to save you. Nature works the way nature works. And there are some things that we cannot see. I mean, there are things that are microscopic that we cannot see, that maybe God will intervene in. But if you can see it, God's not going to play with it. Same puzzle. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught the following rule of thumb, which we shouldn't say. Hanichnas lamoded grano, Omer. If somebody comes to measure their storehouse, it's the equivalent of counting their savings. Omer, they should say, please may it be your will, O God. Please help us. So if you're going to sit down, you're about to, I don't know how many people sit down and look over their monthly statement. Do people do that? My parents used to do that. Maybe they still do. Every month they'd sit there with a statement. I don't know the last time I looked at my statement, which could be terrible. But some people do that. So he says, if you're going to do that, you sit down and before you count, you say, Hashem, please help us. Without saying Hitchel Amud, once you start counting, Omer, you should say Baruch Hashalech Bracha Bechri Azeh. Blessed is the one who gives me blessing in this meeting. You're in the process. You're still inviting bracha, but you recognize, you know, you've only got one page left, and you didn't win the lottery, so you know roughly where you're going. Madad va'achakach beirach. But if you finish counting and then you turn to Hashem and you say, "Please help me," Harzu Tfilat Shav. This is a wasted prayer. It's done. You've counted it. Because bracha cannot come on something that is counted, weighed, and assessed. Only things which are hidden. So now we've been told, having said that God can interact with our lives and our prayers are powerful, there is a firm wall on reality that God has set up how we operate. Did I talk about N64 last week? Did I mention that? I mentioned it at some point last week, or it was a dream, maybe it was in a class at YU. I don't know how many of you play computer games, but there are often cheat codes that you can get for these. And I had an N64 in my adolescence. We had the GoldenEye James Bond game where you were in and shooting people. So there were cheat codes so that none of the other things could see you. So you could just walk around shooting everybody. And after a while, it was meaningless. Just walking around and no one can see you. So if God let us play with nature in that way, our lives would end up being meaningless. So that's the assumption here, that providence only works if it's within the rules of nature. Now, we've got a few statements from Rabbi Yochanan. I think we have six in total, which is going to bring us down to the bottom of the next Amud. Rabbi Yochanan says, Gadol ha-mugsham ki ha-mukibbutz galuyot. We're back to how great rain is. Not only is it as good as revival of the dead or our final redemption, but it's the ingathering of exiles. How do we know? We sing about it every week. Shnei Amar, as it says, Shuvah Hashem et shavitenu, God return. Our captives, ka'afikim b'nekev, like the streams in the Negev. And usually we think about that as a metaphor for how we want the diaspora to stream back. But this is now a metaphor not for how the diaspora will return, but comparing that return to something that we see, which is streams. For ein afikim elamata, rain is as great as people coming back together. Shneimav yu afiki yamas, we know that afikim means streams of water. Rabbi Yochanan says, "Gadol yam hagsham shafilu geisot postot bo." So great is rain, not only because we're comparing it to abstract eschatological happenings, but we know right now when it rains, wars pause. It's too messy for war. I mean, that's not true in an age of drones, but in an age of flanks and battalions, wars would stop when it rains. Shnei Amar, and how do we know? We look at the verse. Talameh Rave, it says it's banks will become moist, nachak gedudah, and it will settle. Gadud can also mean a battalion. So it means everything is going to come to a halt. Now, this is a comment I remember from when I did Tanit with my rabbi when I was young, and it stood out. And this is a moment where we have now our 10th explanation for what stops rain. We've had Bittul Torah, we've had Lashon Hara, we've had Mukul Kalin, that we live in a corrupt age. And this is another very specific term which is going to lead us to think about tzedakah. And there, I imagine this will resonate with some of you who had conversations about this and different cultures. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, "Einak shamim ne'etzarin." Rain is only withheld bishvil poskei tzedakah barabim ve'ein notnin, for people who commit to give charity in public and then do not give. Shnei Amar, as it says, "Nisi'im v'ruach v'geshem ayin." If there's wind and spirits but no rain, Ishmit halal b'matat sheket, that's like a person who sings praise for a false gift. So here the assumption is if one promises to give charity in public and then doesn't give it, that's going to stop rain. It's the equivalent of God saying, I'm going to give you rain, and then not doing it. So I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan now pivots, now we're on to Daf Tet, into the question, when it comes to charity, providence, and you've said now straightforwardly, if I commit and I don't give charity, God is going to withhold rain. So what if I do give charity? So Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan says, Aser ta aser, this is something we learn regularly on Chagim. Aser ta aser means you shall surely give a tithe, which is talking about agriculturally. But here, because of the double language, Rabbi Yochanan suggests, Aser bishvil shetit asher. You should give a tenth in order for what? How do you translate shetit asher? That you become wealthy. Now, I have given you the nekudot, which is very helpful. However, it doesn't actually have nekudot in the original text. And this could be read, aser bishvil shetit aser, meaning tithes so that you'll be able to give tithes again, which is the same end, meaning you'll have money, but it's actually it's promoting virtue as opposed to just one's own interest. But that's right here, that if you give a tithe, you will become wealthy. Anyone ever heard this before, that if you give a tenth of charity, you'll become rich? So this is the origin of that. And I know we could do a whole aside on the study of whether giving a tenth of charity is a biblical obligation. Is it a biblical obligation to give miser money?
Yes.
That's done? All right, we're done. Say again? Correct. It's a Jewish question. It's machlokes. Bottom line, we tend to follow the view that it's not min haTorah, and it's not midrabanan, it's a minhag. It's a good minhag, but the Bach, one of medieval and pre-modern commentaries, say, how do I know that it's not biblical and that it's not even rabbinic? Because he says one person in town does it. He says that it can't be that Jews ignore this biblical obligation. So it must be that it's a minhag, otherwise we judge causing aspersions in the entire Jewish people. And that tends to be the way we view it. The Bavli never suggests, based on a verse, that one has to do this. And I think actually Rabbi Tal from Hollywood, his brother's written a book on the subject of Maisa.
There are a lot of Sfarim on what counts, how you do it.
Right, so
I
this
know
is...
I'm constantly being asked this question. It's amazing. You know,
right.
What you calculate, is it after tax, pre-tax? What you
can you use Can you use school money for this if you pay your tuition? Does that count as Maisa? And so it goes, the people who say it's a minhag, you don't have to do it. They say it's very specific. You have to give a tenth of your income to people in need, but you don't have to. It's a minhag. And the people who say you have to say, well, it also includes buying food and clothes for your family. It also includes tuition for your family. So everybody recognizes it. It's a huge burden for people to give that kind of money. But if you have to, it's very broad. And if you don't have to, it's very narrow. But either way, I just thought I'd note that as a side point so that we could make this relate to current practice. So either way, Rabbi Yochanan says, if you give Maisa money, you will become rich. And what we've just tried to establish is that providence is complicated. I can't test God. Eliezer did that. Yiftach did it. It didn't end so well for him. Ashkei Rabbi Yochanan Liyoka. So Rabbi Yochanan was found himself before the Yonoka de Reish Lakish, the child of Reish Lakish, who happens also, by the way, to be his nephew. Reish Lakish was his brother-in-law. Reish Lakish passed away. Anyone know how Reish Lakish passed away? Quickly is the answer to that, as a result of his brother-in-law giving him a look. Anyone ever given a sibling-in-law a look and felt bad about it? You don't feel as bad as Rabbi Yochanan. He gave him a look, and his brother-in-law withered and passed away. Either way, he now meets his nephew. If you're now the nephew, you might be thinking to yourself, I'm going to avoid this. But his nephew doesn't seem that concerned. His mother will in a minute. Amalei psukech. So Rabbi Yochanan says to his nephew, tell me your pasuk. And the educational system at the time, the young would learn one pasuk a day. My daughter's now doing something called foundations, where they learn a letter a day. They used to do a verse a day. Amalei psukech says, tell me your pasuk. Amalei aser ta'aseh. He says, I'm doing aser ta'aseh today. He says, Amalei umay aser ta'aseh. Okay, and what does that mean? I know you learn the verse now. What is the meaning? Amalei aser bishvil shetasher. It means that if you give maser, you'll become wealthy. Amalei manalach. He says, how do you know that? He says, well, what do you mean, how do you know that? I just told you. He says, but how do you know that that's true, that that works? Amalei says, zil naseh. He says, go try it. This is actually now the child saying to Rabbi Yochanan, how do we know this? And he says, go try it in the world and you'll see that it works. Amalei, and the child says, we can't test God. Don't tell me to go and give a tenth and then see if it works. That's not how providence operates. Amalei hacham, Rabbi Hoshea, and Rabbi Yochanan says, well, this is what Rabbi Hoshea said, chutz mizu. Apart from this, it's true, you're right, you can't test God. This is a single exception. If you give a tenth of your money to charity, you are guaranteed that God will treat you well. That's the view of Rabbi Yochanan, has the name of Yushia. And how do I know? Shneimar, as it says in the Pasuk, Haviyu et kol ma'aser beit ha'otzar, bring your tithe, your tenth, to the storehouse, v'yitera peveiti v'chanun ya'azad amar Hashem Tzvaot, im la'avtach lechem, and I guarantee you, God says, if I don't open up for you, arubut ha'shamayim, the storehouses of the heavens, v'yikoti lechem bracha ad blidai, and I will give you blessing, ad blidai, until it is plenty. My ad blidai, what does it mean, until it is plenty? Amra b'chama amarav, ad sheyiv lusif totechem ilam adai, until your lips are worn out from saying, enough, 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 die, die, die. So, Rabbi Yochanan suggests that based on that verse, we have a guarantee that if one gives a tenth of their income to charity, God will make them rich. I'm not offering that guarantee. I have no insight to that. That's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying to this child on the basis of that verse. And his response is, Amale, the kid says, if I would have got up to that pasuk, I wouldn't need you or your rabbi Hoshea, because I would have seen it in the verse. So when I said to you, how do you know this? You can't test God. And you come to me, oh, well, this is the exception. He said, oh, if I would have got up to that verse, I wouldn't have needed you. And actually, in addition to the providential content of this discussion, we are still reflecting on the educational process that we've been dealing with over the last few dapim, and how complicated it is and how we can learn from our students. But there's also character involved. And we're seeing a level of mistrust, hubris, sarcasm between teachers and students here. We say, oh, I wouldn't have needed you. We said, oh, go try it. It doesn't seem like a healthy relationship, which is about to be brought to an end in a moment. But there's one more engagement. To Ashkechem Yochanan, you know, the Reish Lakish. And another time, Rabbi Yochanan was with his nephew, the child of Reish Lakish. The Yatav, and he was sitting, and the kid said, I don't mean kid just disparagingly, just to identify who we're talking about, he said, Ama Ivelet Adam to Selef Derecho, the sin of a person will corrupt their path. But then they complain that God did it. So now we're having the opposite inflection, where we said, if you give money, God will react well. But there are times in life where you can't blame it on God. When people, because of their own sins, their life gets messed up, and they say, God did this to me. This is all, how could you do this to me, God? That's the pasuk. Where is this pasuk from? Dalet? This is from Mishle, from Proverbs. Yatav Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan hears his nephew saying the Vikam Matme, and he was a little astounded, and he started thinking to himself on the basis of this pasuk that says that we accuse God of things even though it's our fault. Is there anything found in Ketuvim, in Nevi'im, that isn't hinted to in the five books of Moses? Everything in the Chumash foreshadows everything that comes. So this pasuk, it concerns me because I can't think of a biblical precedent in the five books of Moses that people blame God for things of their own fault, that providence doesn't always weave its way into our lives. So the child responds and says, Atu ha mila remize. Surely it is hinted to already. Vaktiv, it says, and this is concerning Yosef's brothers, that when they come out of Egypt and they found money in their bag, which was set up by Yosef, and they turn around and they say, oh my gosh, who did this to us? They blame God. And of course, it's because they sold Yosef. So this is the precedent biblically that sometimes people invoke providence when it's their own fault. It says, V'yetzei libam, their hearts went up, V'yecharedu ish l'achav le'mor, and they were terrified and said to each other, Mazot asal Elohim lanu, what is this that God has done to us? At this point, Rabbi Yochanan thinks, this cheeky nephew of mine comes along. I'm sitting here pondering about where there might be a presence. And he says, well, of course there's a presence. And he quotes something from Bereishis, like I'm not familiar with that. So what happens? Dal enei, and Rashi points out here that Rabbi Yochanan had very long eyebrows. I don't know if any of you ever met anybody with very long eyebrows. I'm not pained with that, because every so often Miriam will say, get them to cut your eyebrows when you go to the haircut guy. But it was covering his eyes, so he would lift up his eyebrows. Who is this guy? And he was about to look at him, and we all remember what happened to Reish Lakish when he looked at him. So this is the moment where the mother intercedes and says, okay, you're coming with me. So the mother comes in and pricks him up, and he says, come on, let's go. I don't want to happen to you what happened to your father. So here we have, in addition, as I say, to the providential discussion here and reflection, another meditation on what it means to have successful education. There has to be a level of respect and trust. Character is involved with the cultivation of knowledge, not just about transmitting information. Now we're back to still Rabbi Yochanan, but some reflections on rain, having taken a side point to think about providence an education. Rabbi Yochanan says, Matil bishvil yachid, parnasa bishvil rabim. We're now going to say that providence can be very particular. Rain will fall bishvil yachid, meaning if one person in this room, their backyard needs rain, and they don't have a sprinkler system and they need rain, it would rain for you if you need it, and you tap providence well. Parnasa, but kind of making a living, meaning the economy working, if you want, is it the Dow Jones, is that what it's called? If you want the Dow Jones to go up, that can't just be for one person. Everybody would have to need that and warrant that and deserve that. But rain can fall for a single person. How do I know that it can rain for one person? It says, God will open up for you in the singular his great storehouse, to give rain to your land. How do I know that the economy prospering is only if the masses deserve it? It says, I will rain for you, plural. Bread and prosperity. Meitvei, we now have a question from a brighter that challenges Rabbi Yochanan. Because Rabbi Yochanan says, Parnasa, the economy will only work if it's in the merit of everybody. And now we're going to have about 15 green lines that are going to bring us to the question. It says, hold on a minute. We know of a case where a single person had merit and the economy thrived for everybody. And that single person is going to be Moses. And on the basis of Moses, the entire generation of the desert prospered. Just in his merit. Nobody else deserved it. So it can't be that Parnasa only works when everybody deserves it. That's going to be the question. So we have made for you a question from a writer. Rabbi Yosef, B'yura Omer, Rabbi Yosef, says the name of Yehuda, Shlosha Parnasim, Tovim, Amduli, Israel. There were three great leaders in Israel. Eluhen, and these are them. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. These were the three great leaders, the three siblings. V'shalosh matanot tova ninu al yadam. And there were three great gifts given by their hand. Be'er va'anan v'man. The well, the protective cloud, and the manna were a result of those three siblings. Be'er b'schut Miriam, the well came in the merit of Miriam. Amun anan b'schut Aaron, the pillar of cloud was because of Aaron. Man b'schut Moshe, and the man was for Moshe. Meta Miriam, and how do I know this? Because when Miriam passed away, Nistalek ha-be'er, the well disappeared. So clearly it was there for her merit. Shnemar, as it says, v'tamat sham Miriam, Miriam died there, it said. And right after that, it says, they didn't have water. So clearly the well disappeared as a result of her passing away. And then it came back because of the merit of Aaron and Moshe. So you still got a plural there that brings back prosperity into the economy. When Aaron passed away, the protective cloud disappeared. As it said, Melacharad heard what happened. What had he heard that gave him confidence that maybe he could attack Israel? Aaron dying doesn't seem to be an inflection point in military advantage. What is it? Shamash made Aaron, he heard that Aaron died, but not only Aaron died, when his taglo aninei kavod, the protective cloud had disappeared. And he thought, now I can attack them. Their, you know, iron dome is down. Not just the general has passed away, I can attack. And how do I know this is the case? This isn't just imaginative midrash, it's based on the verse, imaginatively. Because it says, v'yiru kol ha'edaki gava Aaron, that the entire people saw that Aaron passed away. And now this leads to all sorts of exegetical remarks. How did the entire people see that Aaron passed away? Where was Aaron when he died? Indeed, on the funny mountain. Ha, ha, ha. He was on a har, ha, ha. Thank you for that. And how could everybody have seen him? Anyone know a midrashic response to how everybody saw Aaron passed away? Right, Rashi cites a midrash that they all saw the Satan had this big image of Aaron passed away that he put up in the sky, and they all saw it. And that's one way. Malbim suggests Kol HaHedah in this context doesn't refer to the entire arm, it refers to the Sanhedrin. The Edah specifically means Sanhedrin, and they all went to see that the high priest had passed away, and it legitimized the transfer of power onto the next generation. But there's another way. It says, V'yiru, Aldigru, V'yiru. Don't read it that they all saw, but V'yareyu, they were all seen. Aaron passed away, the cloud disappeared, and they were all seen as a result. And that's what he heard. Either way, there's a long way to say the cloud disappeared when he passed away. The Rish Lakish and Rish Lakish proves that Yareu can mean this, because Ki Mashma Barba Lashonot, because Ki can mean one of four things. It can mean E, Dilma, Ella, Daha. It can mean if, perhaps, because, or but. So when it says v'yiru kol ha'edah ki gava Aaron, that they all saw that Aaron died, it could mean they were all seen because Aaron died. Long way to say v'chazru shnehem b'schut Moshe. But then now the well went when Miriam passed away and came back for Aaron and Moshe. The cloud went when Aaron passed away, and then they were both still in effect because just of Moshe. So you've got the whole economy hanging on Moshe. The well that gives them water is there. The cloud that protects them and keeps them stable is there. The food that keeps them fed is there, all on the merit of one person. So how can you say Parnassah only works for the Rabbim? Mate Moshe nistaglu kulam. Moshe passed away and everything disappeared. So we all know that it was due to him that they were there. Shneimar, as it says, and now we've got a verse that we'll repeat in a moment. Va'achid et shlosha orim b'yerech echad. I will take out, or the demise of three leaders will happen in 1 month, is a pasuk that appears in Zechariah in reference to this moment. V'chib yerech echad metu. Did they all die in the same months? It's not true. Miriam metu b'nissan, Aaron b'av, Moshe b'adar. They died in three different months and in different years. So how can the pasuk in Zechariah think back nostalgically in the time of the desert and say three leaders were taken out in a single month? Ella, what does it mean? That the gifts that were in their merit all disappeared in the same month, meaning when Moshe passed away, they all disappeared, even though that really they were initially there only because of his siblings. Alma, so this all comes to tell us one central fact that refutes Rabbi Yochanan's claim, which is Ashulchan Parnasa Bishvil Yachid. The economy can lie on the shoulders of a single person. So Rabbi Yochanan, how can you say that economy only works for the masses? Shani Moshe. Moshe is different. Kim de la Rabim Habai, Karabim Dami. Since he was needed by the masses, he was the equivalent of the masses. And I've heard occasionally people make this point. If you want to ensure your own protection providentially, make yourself necessary for other people. Because then, again, I'm not in the business of offering guarantees, but I've heard people not offering guarantees, but around time when people are making pledges and things, if you're Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, if you want to assure yourself a good year and protect yourself, make sure that other people need you. Because if other people need you, Hashem's not going to take you out of the system when other people are dependent on you. Again, I'm not in the business of offering guarantees, but there is this theme that arrives here from Moshe, that Moshe had more merit because people needed him. And because people needed him, he was more than just one person. He was actually a stand-in for the masses. And the truth is, I'm sure we've seen this in life, where there are nations that are in the process of developing, and there's an assumption that the guy or person who is leading that nation right now, if they were taken out, the whole government would fall. That they have a unique character, a unique charisma, a unique following, that if they were taken out, everything would fall apart. And this happens when America gets involved with nation building in other places. They try to insulate a particular figure they think is, and this happens in fiction. You see this on 24 in the West Wing, where they're like, this person, if you take them out of the picture, everything is going to collapse. They're necessary. And this is the assumption about Moshe. And at that point, providentially, they're not just a single person. Everything depends on them. Now, because we cited that verse, that three leaders will be taken out in one day, we have a small legend, a Agadata, that speaks about a dream in which a sage heard this, but it also refers back to education as being more than just a transfer of information. Rav Huna bar Munach, bar Manoach, Rav Shmuel bar Idi, v'Rav Chia mevas Danya. There were these three students, Huna, Shmuel, and Chia, havshchichi gidamei de Rava, and they used to go to Rava's school, and they would come to his shir every Sunday. They would have bagels, and they would listen to Rava. Kinach nafshei de Rava. When Rava passed away, the three of them said, "Okay, we're not, on vacation now. We need a new teacher. We need a new shir to go to." So atulakamei de Rav Papa. They used to go to Rav Papa's shir on Sunday, but guess what? You're used to your own teacher. You now have a new teacher, different style, different predilection. It's not quite the same. Kol emat dahava amalu shmaitid lavi mistabrilu. Every time he would say something that they would think to themselves, "Ah, can you hear this guy? It doesn't really sound right." Hava muramze adadi. They'd give each other a look. And I don't know how many of you ever stood in front of a class teaching, but you can tell when people are like, winking at each other or thinking to each other, or occasionally in stern, talking very loudly to each other while you're standing there, 3 feet away. And like, yeah, I can hear you. In fact, you're on Zoom being recorded right now. So Rav Papa's standing there and he's teaching, and he sees every time he says something, and he knows, and as a teacher you also know when you're going out on a limb, when you're trying to be homiletic, or you're stretching a case, and he's got this sensitivity, he's saying something, he knows it's a risk, it makes him vulnerable because it's a homiletic notion, and he sees them looking at each other, chalish daite, and it made him feel weakened, he lost, it makes you feel bad, and speaking not only as somebody who teaches, but with a spouse where we both teach, a huge amount of our confidence and esteem is heavily dependent on the people we engage with during the day. We come back, if we've had a bad day of teaching, it makes us feel terrible. It didn't work. In the same way, if you're an engineer and you try to fix a car all day and it works perfectly, that's great. And if nothing comes together, you feel like it just wasn't happening today. I remember a number of doctors when the pandemic first started. Doctors often feel like, I know when something's going to work and when it doesn't work. I know which medicines work and which don't. And a number of doctors, when there was a huge psychological trauma that I'm trying really hard and people are just dying. And I've never had this before in my life, where I do things that I know should work and it's just not happening. And to some degree, teachers, Havdil in a very different way, face this every day. And it's not just science, because kids can be disruptive and it's not your fault. But either way, Chalash Date, he felt very weak because of their treatment. Akriya b'chalme, so he, in a dream one night, he heard read to him, V'achid et shloshet haroim, I will wipe out three leaders. Meaning the three students have been causing him havoc in class, and he gets a dream at night saying, I'm going to wipe out three guys. So if you're now with Papa, what are you thinking to yourself? Uh-oh, or? Right, you're saying, fantastic. Tomorrow is going to be the last day.
I can't tell you how much pleasure.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much pleasure it gives me. Yeah, that was risky. So you don't know the ones I don't say. So he hears this pasuk, l'machar, and there are two ways to read what he's about to do. The next day, kihava miftrimine, when the students were leaving, he said to them, amalahu, he said, lizlu rabbanam bishlama, go in peace. Now, how might you read that?
I'm not going to see you again.
Yeah, it's meaning like, have a great day, you know, rest in peace, guys. It could be read, or it could be that he... Right, so you could read this as actually, and I think Seth mentioned this to me as well, that Rav Papa, and that's why we use Rav Papa's family in when we finish a siyum, say Chan Rav Papa, Rabbanan Papa, because Rav Papa's, his M.O. was to harmonize and bring people together. So this has often not been read in that sarcastic way, but he's now terrified that because of the pain he's felt, that they're going to suffer. And the truth is, say again?
It's a bracha.
So what he's saying is, you should go in peace, you should be protected. And actually, here there's a huge amount of weight put on one letter, which is he says to them, Lazarabanan Bishlama. Now, if somebody's leaving, Friday night when we sing and the angels leave, say Tchem, Lashalom. And if you look here, there's actually a girsa change. I can't find it on this layout, where some say it shouldn't say Bishlama, it should say Lishlama, because he's giving a bracha. Where is it? You see? Left side. Oh, so right at the bottom, underneath where you've got Rashi, it says Hagaot v'tziyunim, notes and notes. And it says Lishlama. There are other girsas that say, go to peace. And this is often said, when you say goodbye to somebody, never say Seitchem b'shalom, because we say rest in peace. That's not just a Christian saying, that comes from Jewish life. That Seitchem b'shalom means rest in peace. Seitchem l'shalom means go to peace, meaning keep going. And either way, it could be read in different ways. There is a joke about what do you say? Oh, maybe I should save it for Sudash Lashir. You know, what do you say to somebody on the 120th birthday? Have a nice day. So he's saying to them, you know, what do they say to them? Lazer Rabbanan Bishlama, you know, go in peace, have a good day. But either way, so that was one complication in education where the same verse comes up that we just cited with Moshe and his sibling. Rav Shimi Bar Ashi says, Havashchir Kameh de Rapapa. Rav Shimi used to be in Rav Papa's class. And here we have another challenge that sometimes we face in education that is no one's particular fault. Hava Magshele Tuva, and Rav Shimi used to ask fantastic questions. You'd be sitting there, and I'm sure you can imagine times when you've been either in a shir or a class or a context where a teacher is trying to teach and somebody is asking questions. It just pulls the rug under their feet every time. It gets them and they don't know what to say. They're not sure how to answer, and it kind of decimates the presentation. So Yom Achad, one day Rav Shimi was in shul, sitting near this rabbi, Rav Papa. Chase denafal al ape, he saw he was falling down on his face, meaning he was saying tachanun. Shame da amar achmana, and he heard him over saying in the middle of tachanun, he was, you know, down on his face, begging God for assistance, and he heard him say, amar achmana, to saying to God, litzan mekesufa de Shimi, please, save me from Shimi's sharpness. Which can be read differently, but just please stop this guy asking questions when I'm teaching. Which tells you, again, an insight into him as a teacher, that he lived with it.
Some people, you know, professionally, they're in and they're out. They don't invest particularly heavy in it because they don't want it to be tied to their self-esteem and confidence. They kind of extract. But he's in the middle of prayer when he could be talking about the kind of vacations he wants, the kind of income he wants, the kind of life. He's thinking about, I want my work to feel productive. I want to have a sense of esteem that I'm being successful. And I need Shimi to stop asking these questions. And what happens? This is a counterbalance story. God doesn't loom down. Nobody gets wiped out. But Shimi, the student, hears his teacher. Kabbalah le shikuta, and he accepted on himself silence. V'tulo agshel, and he didn't ask any more questions. So we've got two counterbalance stories where kind of arrogant students are haunted by God, and the teacher has to intercede for them. And here where you've got a student who doesn't mean to be provocative, but happens to be, and overhears and tries to learn from that. And the Havdil, if you want, I actually remember being the irritating student in this regard. When I was in graduate school, I would often ask a question, and I thought I was being helpful to the class. And at one point, I heard the teacher say something or like roll their eyes. And I said, I'm not saying this to be contrarian. And she said, oh, really? And then carried on. And I thought, oh, I didn't realize that you felt that way. And I stopped asking questions. I didn't hear her saying Tachanun or anything. But one tries to be sensitive. That I'm not trying to disrupt. I thought this was helpful. Yeah.
Could be that this teacher was not really davening, but was trying to be overheard.
Yes, it could well be that Rav Papa's sitting here and he sees Shimi's next to him and he sees, I don't want to tell Shimi. And it's fascinating. Yeah, the teachers are also sensitive. How do I communicate this without breaking them as a student? I don't want to turn around and say, you need to stop asking questions. So I'll daven. And I'll just let them understand that this is troubling me and not think, and let them also know that I didn't want to say anything to them. So there is a trust there. Fascinating. Thank you. Indeed. So now we continue back to, does rain fall for the single person? And so if later this morning you go out to your backyard and you look around and you say, there are three blades of grass there that need rain, we're going to see that that might be a productive way to operate. So we've now entertained whether Parnassa works for the many or only for the one. And we've said Parnassa, the economy, it's not up to, we can't look in the mirror or look up to the sky and say, I need the economy to succeed on my basis. Because God's going to say, it doesn't work like that. Unless you're a Moshe, unless the world depends on you, I can't make the economy float for you. In the same way we've said, "Ena bracha ela b'simum einayim." Bracha only works on things that are hidden. You can't come up and say, make the economy flourish for me. Rain, however, is, and this is what makes rain unique, is that it is a form of objective providence that can be very localized. And that's why it's suggested it can fall for the Yachid. Amri Shlakish, Shlakish says, Minayin l'mazal b'shvil Yachid, how do I know that rain can fall for the single person? We had one pasuk over the page, but we can have an even more explicit connection. Dechtiv, as it says, Shalom e'ashem matar beit malkosh. Pray for rain from God in the time of the rain season, the late rain season. Hashem oseh chazizim, and God will make chazizim, which means clouds. Umatar geshem yiten lahem, he will give rainwater into them, le'ish esef besadeh, to a person for grass in their field. Yachol lakol, so you might think God says, if you pray for rain, I'll give if everybody needs it. Talmud loma le'ish, so it says, no, a person. God will give you rain if a person needs it. V'tanya I le'ish, and you might think, oh, if it's only for a person, yachol lakol so latav, it would only be if all your fields need it. Talmud loma sadeh, it says field in the singular. And e sadeh, if you think only if the whole field needs it, God will give me rain. Yachol lachol sadeh, talmud loma esef, even a blade of grass. So Reish Lakish suggests from here, if in your life you need rain for a single patch of grass, ask for it. And if you merit it, it will come. How do I know? Ki hadar of Daniel Bar Katina, because we have a story of Daniel Bar Katina. Havalehi ganinta, he had this garden. Kol yoma hava azav v'sayla, and every day he would go out to his garden and he would look around. He would survey the garden. Amar, and he would say, Hamishrabai Maya, this row needs water. Hamishrabai Maya, and this row doesn't need water. Va'ate mitra v'kamashke kol hechdi v'bayle Maya, and water would come and water only the parts that he needed. To suggest that Rav Daniel had a unique connection to God and depended on this kind of providence. Now a reflection on part of that pasuk. My Hashem oseh chazizim. What does it mean that God makes clouds chazizim? Amar Rabbi Yosi Bachanina. Rabbi Yosi Bachanina says melamed shekol tzadik v'tzadik hashbaruch hu oseh chaziz b'fnei atzmo, that it teaches that for every pious person, God will make their own personal cloud. Anyone who ever seen a Frozen or got kids or grandkids, what's his name? The snowman? Olaf gets his own personal flurry. He's very excited about that, clearly inspired by this passage. in the Gemara that God, and it, because it's in the plural, chazizim, God will make it clouds. The assumption is God will make a personal cloud. So again, you look up in the sky and we imagine there are meteorological effects that lead to all these things. Chazal is saying, if one merits it, God can make a particular cloud for you, bring it over the house, and rain on a particular patch. Rav Yehuda says, my chazizim, what are chazizim? Now that you've mentioned, we're all going to get one. Porachot, flying clouds. And this is where I get out of my homiletic depth, because there's going to be a lot of meteorological assumptions. At the bottom of this stuff in the blue, there is a debate about whether rain comes from the oceans or from some trans-atmospheric storehouse, which sounds like a debate about where does rain come from? Does it evaporate and fall, or does it come from the cosmos? Both. Say again?
Both.
To some degree, I mean, what do you mean it's both?
It's a cycle.
It's a cycle, right. And one side will say, oh, of course it comes from up there, but it evaporates and then goes up. And the other says, no, clouds go up without rain, and then they get filled with rain in the sky from God's storehouses. And that sounds like it's a debate about how the science works. Say again? There you go, convective clouds. We'll salvage it. Good. So maybe we'll manage to resolve that. So let's finish this reflection, and it's going to lead us to an odd place in a moment. Amar Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda says, Parachot, Chazizim mean flying clouds. Amar Rav Yochanan said, similar mata, Parachot, and actually a signal of rain coming is clouds that move. Harvey's nodding, so maybe this is... Okay, great. They move faster. Great, and the truth is sometimes, like, you look up in the sky, I can't really see the clouds moving that quickly, but sometimes clouds are very low, and like I'll say to my kids, wow, look at that cloud, it's like racing across the sky. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, that's a simon for rain. My parachot, what are these flying clouds? Amar Rabbi Papa says, Eva Kalisha tute Eva Semichte. It is thick clouds beneath thin clouds. All right, I'll take your word for it. Amar Rabbi Yehuda says, Nehili Mekane Mitra. If it starts... what is that called when it rains a little bit?
Drizzle.
Drizzle. If it's drizzling before it rains, meaning it's drizzling and it hasn't rained yet, Ate Mitra, that means rain is coming. So if you look outside and it starts drizzling, that means rain is coming. Bata Mitra, but if it's been raining and then you see it's drizzling, Pasik Mitra, that means the rain is about to stop. So we're now trying to establish some firm... It's complicated whether we're trying to establish firm scientific rules or firm providential rules. Is this a signal, oh, it's going to stop raining, that's what happens, or God is somehow taking this back now? Makme Mitra Ate Mitra. So he's now going to give us a way to remember this. Images which I imagine will be emblazoned in your minds in perpetuity. How do I know that if it drizzles first, that it's about to start raining? Simanech Mahulta. Think about, in your mind, a sieve. I don't know how many of you do baking. If you fill a sieve, you call them sieves?
Yes.
Sieves?
Yes.
So you fill a sieve with flour. First you have like a cloud of flour that comes out. Little bits come out. And then if you shake it, the larger bits start coming out. So if you start seeing a drizzle, it's an indication there's a whole storehouse of rain that's about to come flooding out. The Bata Mitra, if you see that it's been raining and now it's drizzling, Pasik Mitra, you know it's going to stop. How do you know, Simanach? And I imagine many of us have seen this. Charya de Izzy, the way that goats have dung. Anyone seen goats relieving themselves? Not particularly. I'm sure when we take kids to farms and say, oh, look, it's going to the bathroom. Obviously not going to the bathroom. But the indication was that goats would have these large droppings and then followed by small droppings afterwards, which is an indication it's finishing. And therefore, if it starts drizzling after it's been raining, it's in your mind you have this image, you know, oh, it's going to stop. And the truth is, like some other odd moments in the Talmud, it makes one think, it can't just be this is the only possible mnemonic he could find. There's an indication here that sieve is you're about to make food. This is a promising symbol in the mind to think, oh, it's drizzling, it's about to pour rain, which is an indication that I'm about to have flour, I can make something out of this. If the rain's receding, there's a drizzle, it's like goat dung, meaning this wasn't pleasant. This was not providence giving you a gift. This is a signal that God is withdrawing rain and kind of dumping this on you, forgive the turn of phrase, in this context, with a sign of displeasure. So it's an image to think practically, but also a suggestion of how the providence works. Full stop. Ula. Now, having established that rain works a very specific way and you could read into it a very specific way, we're about to show that actually this doesn't always work. And anyone who's ever been a weather person or weather presenter will know that you make predictions and everybody says, really? I think we're going to get up to the yellow. Maybe we'll do the next blue. We'll see. Ul-Eklila Bavel. Ul was visiting Bavel in Babylon. And we can see that it's either Bavel or generally the diaspora. He's no longer standing in Israel at the peak in the perfection of Jewish history. Chaza Porachot. And he saw these flying clouds. And what does this cloud mean, Harvey, if it says flying clouds? It means it's going to rain. That's what Rav Papa said. It's going to rain if you see Porachot. Amalahu. And Rav Ulu, who's visiting Bavel, says to everybody, Panumane, I'll get all the things inside. Hashta Adimitra, rain's coming. Everybody get it in. Lasoflo Adimitra. Rain didn't come. So Amalahu, what did he say? He didn't say, oh, I missaw. He said, Ki hechi de mishakki le bavlai, just as these Babylonians are liars, have a mishakki mitra, so too are their clouds liars. So what we suggest here is that it's not a guarantee. We don't know how this works. Providence is complicated. And to say, I know that if you give a tenth to charity, you are guaranteed. And then next week someone says, you know, I gave up 10% of my income. I don't have any money now. Where is it? Like, what can I say? You know, you look silly when that happens. And the suggestion of the Gemara here is for everything we say, we need to take it with a pinch of salt or a pinch of flour, whatever metaphor you prefer, that is complicated. And the suggestion, again, that he went to Bavel is an assumption that we're not in the perfect place historically. It doesn't have to be Babylon being liars in particular, although a lot of people try to figure out why Babylonians are liars. I don't know if it's nationally directed this. Ulekla Bavel, another time Ula went to Bavel, and now we've got a suggestion about not everything is the way it seems. He went to visit Bavel on another occasion. Chazam Malat Sinna de Tamar Bezuz, and he saw they were selling basketful of dates for a single zuz. And you think, this is a smashing deal. A whole basket of dates for one zuz. A friend of mine went to Panama over vacation time in the summer, and he said, it's amazing. You go to Panama, you stay in the best hotel, and it's like $10 for the night. If you're looking for a vacation, a lot of kosher food, and apparently everything is very cheap by American standards. So he's in, he sees this whole basket of dates for one zuz, and he says, how can it be? Amar malat sinna dedusha bezuza. In this place, they've got a whole basket full of dates for a single zuz. Vavlailo asko baraita, and they're not learning Torah all day. Meaning, things are so cheap here. Why are they chasing money when they could be learning all day? And again, Bavel could be an implication for the diaspora, meaning you're sitting in a place, the economy's thriving, life, you know, they're expensive things, but life written large is easy to make. Why isn't everybody learning all day? He was astounded by this. So then he goes home and he eats his whole basket full of dates. I don't know how dates work generally, but Leil Yetzaruhu. But for him, that night was a painful night, which Rashi suggests he spent the night in the bathroom, meaning he ate a whole thing of dates. He was uncomfortable. Amar, and what did he think in the morning? His reflection was, Mala Tzana de Sakina Bazuza. They have a whole basket full of knives, and it costs you a whole zuz, Bavlai Aski Baraita, and they still find time to learn Torah. It's unbelievable, this place. Meaning yesterday I thought life was so easy for them, how can they not be learning more? And today I realize actually this was a terrible deal. I paid a whole zuz for something that kept me in the bathroom all night. That's not pleasant. So, and they still managed, despite the fact that life is a challenge, to learn Torah. It's an amazing thing. So having said that all Babylonians are liars, we now have a position that says Babylonians actually live a life of commitment despite the fact that life is hard, even though I wouldn't have known that from looking from the outside. You have to be in their shoes to see that life actually is a little harder, and yet they still succeed. Okay. We'll get through this very quickly. There's dark blue, and then we'll stop before the green. Tanya was talking about Rabbi Lezer, and Rabbi Lezer says, Kolom kolom in mei okianus hu shota. Rabbi Lezer, we're going to have a debate now between Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua. These figures are going to debate where water comes from, where rain comes from. Rabbi Lezer has a view, it all comes from the ocean. Okianus hu shota, I'm sorry if this dark blue is hard to see. It says it comes from the ocean. Shneimar, as it says, ve'ed ya'alem in ha'aretz, this mist came up from the ground, v'hashkayet kol pnei adama, and fed. Anyone know where that pasuk is from? Right at the beginning, that there was this mist that came up from the ground and fed everything. So it sounds like God installs one of these kind of misty sprinkler systems. But Rav Eliezer says, no, this is how water works. It comes off the ocean and it comes down. He set up evaporation in paradise. Amar Bishur of Yeshua says, hold on a minute. I've been in the sea. Halam Amekianus Meluchin Hain. It's pretty salty. That's not the stuff that falls on my fields. It can't be. Amalo Mamtikin Ba'avim. No, it gets sweetened in the clouds. Now, of course, that's not how evaporation works. It kind of leaves the salt behind, but it's a similar thing that as it goes up into clouds, it gets sweetened, it leaves the salt behind. Rabbi Shura disagrees, and he says, Kol ha'olam kulam imaim elyonim hu shote. No, they all drink from the upper waters. How do I know? Shnei amar l'mata shamayim tishtemayim, that it says, the rains of the heavens shall give you water, meaning the rain comes from the heavens, not from the oceans. So what am I going to do with that verse that says steam mist came off the ground? It teaches you that clouds evaporate off the sea. But what are clouds for him? They're kind of like, yeah, containers. They're kind of like these misty containers that rise off the ground. And they open up their openings like a wine, what are those cool things? Spigot, flask, like a flask. They open up like a flask. And rain gets filled in from up there in the heavens. As it says, I will bequeath water, rain to the mist. And the clouds he adds on, by the way, clouds are like poked like sieves, because now you're thinking, well, how does the rain get out? If the cloud is a container and it fills up with a hole in the top, it doesn't all fall out, it's clearly covered up. So how does it work? He said, oh, well, they've got little perforations in the bottom like a sieve, and then they come down and it kind of scatters it like sieves. It's an intriguing possibility. Historically, you could see this as they honestly think clouds work differently. It's hard to imagine looking at clouds that you could think that it literally works that way, and presumably there is some philosophical reflections to be had on this, but we don't have time, which is my code to say that I didn't have time to think about it. He says, and if you think about how it's physically stored, there is like a hairbreadth between each raindrop in the cloud. So it all gets stored from heaven. There's tiny little storage for raindrops, and there are little perforations in the bottom, and they drop out, which again feeds into the notion that God can visit this down very specifically. And writ large, this debate, whether scientific or not, beneath it is a debate, is does rain work as a natural phenomenon, or is this a gift of God that comes from on high, works like a sieve, can come down to your field, or is this, no, there is a system in place, and it's actually not some oil in our iron. We know how this works. We'll just do the green because it will take 30 seconds. And this all comes to teach us. It repeats to us one of the great things that rain is like, that it's as great as the creation of the world. It says in one passage, God does great things beyond our comprehension. And in the same parak in Job, it says, and God gives rain, so the rain is one of these great things that he does beyond our understanding. And it says elsewhere, when it speaks about creation, it says there's no understanding. So this has actually appeared on the first daf of Tanit, where we suggested that rain is called Gvurot because of a comparison with Job and creation. And here we have that repeated full stop. Next time we're going to do the bottom piece of this, and then we'll do Daf Yud, which will bring us to two new Mishnayot. So we are going to get to the end of reflections on this one Mishnah, have two more, and we'll go ahead from there. And I want to just wish congratulations. We've done up to Daf Ted Amud Bet. We're making great progress. And welcome again to the Daf Yomi, folks. Thank you, John, for sponsoring this morning. Shamshadav and Aliyah, I wish you all a wonderful day.